Spirit Radio Podcasts.
You know, in political life, there are events that become watersheds because they set new precedents. Sometimes unwritten rules are broken, accepted conventions are reinterpreted to get something over the line. And I think if you've been following the abortion debate that's been in the Dáil in the last number of days, or indeed if you watched any of the discussions in the Health Committee, you might actually agree that is that one of those watersheds, just in terms of the tone, the language used, the kind of petulant attitude at times, the disdain for, you know, politicians who disagreed with one another, how that kind of came across. Now, the abortion bill, of course, passed report stage in the Dáil this week. And Minister for Health Simon Harris hailed it as a new era for Irish women. He must also be aware that this is a new era for healthcare workers, who of course are expected to carry out the requirement of this bill. And just this morning on the front pages of the papers, consultants, obstetricians voicing their concerns about how the legislation is being rushed through in, I quote, a frenzied way. And we've heard concerns this week from GPs and indeed midwives as well. So as the country prepares for one of the greatest changes in medical practice since the foundation of the state, what new political precedents have been set, and how is that likely to affect political life in the future? On the line to give us her thoughts, we have our regular political commentator, Susan Phillips. Susan, good morning to you.
Good morning, Wendy.
Well, obviously I'm giving the update of what's happened this week, but we might backtrack a little bit in terms of the history and where the bill is at now.
Yes, well, we have a written constitution, so we can't have a law that contradicts it, so we all know that. So in 1983, an article was added to the constitution through referendum, which gave equal right to life to mother and unborn, and that was a result of the very liberal abortion legislation that had come in Britain. So that made sure that nobody could bring in legislation on abortion. However, in 1991, the X case was paramount because judges there accepted that this equality of right to life disappeared if the mother was about or did take her own life. But nothing was legislated for it until 2016, when the Protection of Life During Pregnancy Act was passed, and that allowed abortion in Ireland where there was a risk of suicide. So fast forward to May's referendum, which was to physically remove the eighth in total, and it was passed by 66% to 33%. That means that legislation is now being undergone in the Dáil, and it goes to the Senate, and then after that it has to go to the President to be signed.
So in terms of the debate to date, have you seen much of what's been happening in the Dáil? What do you think, Justin? Obviously, a lot of the discussion has been about amendments that have been put forward. And I think probably a lot of people, whatever their opinion or whoever they vote on abortion, might be kind of shocked to see some of the amendments that have been shot down.
Well, I think that anybody that saw anything of the Dáil, and don't forget that late on Wednesday night, that's just this Wednesday, the Dáil voted by 90 votes to 15 with 12 abstentions that this, we call it the Regulation of Termination of Pregnancy Bill, has effectively gone through the Dáil. So now, as we know, it has to go to the Senate. Now, it went to the Senate this week just for one day, and then next week it proceeds on to the committee stage. And rather like in the Dáil, the senators will go through the legislation section by section. Some will table a number of amendments like they did in the Dáil, which were unsuccessful. And then ultimately, and they're sitting for extra days next week, it's assumed that by Thursday everything will be wrapped up and the Senate will pass it. Now, if the Senate actually votes for an amendment, and they probably won't, but if they did, which is in addition to what was decided by the Dáil, then it has to go back to the Dáil for them to agree that the Senate amendment is justified. But, you know, you're talking about, Wendy, you're talking about an atmosphere, which, okay, we could see it on television in the Dáil, where it was really just so rude and so forgetful that 33%, that's one in every three Irish people, turned out and voted against removal of the eighth. So it was, as you say, I thought it was very distasteful.
What does that say just about, especially when you consider, Susan, that Fianna Fáil had been given a free vote on this issue? When you have a situation that one in three voters voted no, but you don't have a situation where one in three political representatives voted against the legislation, so why are we finding that those people aren't being adequately politically represented?
I think what happened was that when some of the TDs, representatives, saw that it was a pretty strong yes let's remove its vote, they probably went a bit quiet. But that doesn't mean to say that they all did. But in the amendments, there were 65 amendments suggested in the Dáil, which this, you know, ended this week. And I'll just give you a couple of examples. They were all absolutely screamed down in a most unpleasant way. I'll just give you some examples of what they were. One was an amendment to suggest that what an amendment, by the way, is an addition to what is in the legislation, which is the statement of the act of the bill, rather. So one was, what information could a doctor record about a patient? Some people thought that maybe doctors should know about previous abortions, or perhaps had the patient had an ectopic pregnancy or stillbirth. That was just one thing that was absolutely shot down. Another was, for example, this was really very moving, an amendment on the disposal of fetal remains. That was shot down. Whether information could be provided on selective termination such as gender, you know, could you be aborted just because you were a girl after the 12 weeks? Is that because the first 12 weeks, as we know, is absolutely everybody, anything, anyhow? So some of these amendments obviously referred to after the first 3 months. And then there was just this remark by some of the pro-lifers in the Dáilers, these amendments are archaic and objectionable. And then, Wendy, did you see the one, the amendment on parental notification? Now, that was rejected. Now, it wasn't so odd. Shouldn't parents of somebody under 18 perhaps be informed that their child was going to have an abortion? That was absolutely shocking.
Yeah,
down.
I think I was thinking, I was always with these amendments, I was trying to think of in the headspace of someone, you know, doesn't have a strong position either way, or maybe even a yes voter. And I was trying to think, you know, say I had a daughter who I find out when she's 18, 19, say I find her self-harming. And the only reason I'm giving that example is because we had an interview during the week of a woman talking about that experience after abortion. And I don't even know that she's been going through this or suffering afterwards as her parent. I just find that so distressing.
It's very strange. And then did you see, Wendy, that the independent TD, Michael Collins, he actually made the point in the Dáil. He said, look, people under the age of 18, they can't join the army, they can't register to vote, they can't leave home without parental consent, they can't even get their teeth whitened. And yet, in this case, they are going to be allowed to have an abortion without the parents being notified. Did you see that?
Yeah, it is bizarre when you think about it in those terms, for sure. So just wanted to ask you then, one of the things that was the quotes which I mentioned in the papers today, and it was from a consultant obstetrician gynecologist from the Coombe Hospital saying basically the frenzied way in which the government is trying to introduce this abortion legislation by January is actually quite dangerous. Why is there such a railroading of this legislation, do you think, Susan?
Well, yes, I saw that remark by Professor Chris Fitzpatrick. But you see, what's happened is that Minister Harris is in a terrible hurry, and this is what he said. He said, it's gone through the Dáil, but you, senators, I'm urging you to do your job and deliver the promise that was made to the Irish public that services would begin at the start of January. And Simon Harris has stated that the services should be available in all maternity units from the outset. And you can imagine that that is just so difficult. And as you said, you know, the Coombe Hospital professor says that if this legislation is rushed, we're introducing a new termination of pregnancy service, which, if rushed into operation, could pose a serious threat to the health and well-being of women. And then you've got even, you know, who's very sensible, independent Senator Michael McDowell, who I think is pro-choice, but he actually said adequate time has to be given. And then on the other side, you've got Senator Rona Mullen just saying that, you're hurrying this through, but actually the legislation does exactly what it says on the tin. It ends the lives of unborn children. You know, so there's still the old differing opinions coming up. But I think the answer to your question is that the minister had kind of said, I will get all this started up by January. And then, of course, you know, you could honestly agree with former Sinn Féin Paddy Tobin, who just said, how on earth can the minister probably provide these services when what he presides over at the moment with the health service is so chaotic? And it does make you wonder, doesn't it?
Well, this is the thing, I suppose. If his reasoning is saying, well, I said I would introduce it by January, well, you could go back and a lot of things that the health minister said, like reducing the numbers on trolleys. I mean, the list could go on and on. But this particular promise, he seems to be adamant on adhering to, no matter what the cost.
Yes, you see, I think the complexity is that I'm not sure about this, and Wendy, you can correct me, but I imagine that the giving out of a prescription for the abortion pill is probably the very simple end of procedures. And I think it's the services that would be required to fit the bill, well, if when it becomes an act, after the 3 months, because, you know, it says under certain conditions. So I imagine that that is what is the area where Simon Harris is saying we've got to set up a lot of organisational issues and procedure information. I think the doctors are getting a day of teaching. And maybe it's that end. I mean, as you know, if we've got ordinary people with pneumonia on trolleys, you could say, well, where are these extra rooms going to be provided for the abortion services?
Just one of the many questions I know people have. Thank you so much, Susan, for joining us on the programme this morning. That's our political analyst there, Susan Phillips. Do you know that more than 40% of asylum seekers are spending 2 years in direct provision living in accommodation centres? That includes, by the way, almost 2,000 children. Well, our next guest has first-hand experience of the direct provision system in this country, as her and her children lived in direct provision for many years as asylum seekers. On the line to tell us about the current situation and share with us a little bit of her story, we've Ellie Kasiyombe, who's the co-founder and director of Our Table. Ellie, good morning to you.
Good morning, how are you? And thanks for having me.
Ellie, maybe just tell us a little bit about yourself and your story of coming to Ireland.
I actually came from Malawi almost a decade ago and came here to seek asylum. And till then, I find myself in direct provision now. Actually, I'm a little bit sorry because I'm in a bus which carries us from the centre to town centre. So maybe there might be a little bit noise, but yeah, I hope you can hear me.
We'll call that atmosphere on the radio this morning, Ellie.
Yeah, sure. So I left Malawi on the reasons that I really moved over here to seek for protection, for the reasons that I left here, because it was really hard for me. I could have lost my life, so I really had to get a safety place. That's why I found myself in Ireland. Yeah.
And then when you got to Ireland, were you sent to a direct provision centre, or what happened next?
Yeah, so when I moved over here, I seeked asylum, and after I seek asylum, then I was sent to the place that I'm living now. It's called Barseskin Reception Centre, so I was sent there. And that's when my process started. And I didn't even thought that I'll be, years later, like today, I'll be being driven in the same bus that drove me years back. But anyway, this is where I am. And that's what happens when you found yourself in this system.
And tell us a little bit about what life was like living in direct provision and how long you were there for. What was it like for you and for your children?
I'm still in direct provision, so the life still continues. The same life still continues. It's not an easy life to live, you know. You live in a room like me and my daughter. We share one room, and my son, he lives in the other room. We are one of the lucky people that we live at that center, and we can actually, me and my son, we can live in a separate room, because otherwise we could live in the same room, all three of us. But we're just unfortunate that at least my son can have his room at the moment, but me and my daughter, we share a room. So you wake up every morning, you go to the canteen and, you know, eat your breakfast, and you go for lunch, take your dinner, lunch, and then you go for dinner in the evening. So that's basically daily routine. And the time I was coming, there was no such things like right to work or education or stuff like that. So for us, mainly, it was just like waking up, go to the canteen, get first meal, go back, watch a little bit telly, and come back and go to the canteen again. So that was the routine, really. And, you know, just sleeping mainly and doing nothing. Yeah.
Which must be very, very difficult when you probably want to be able to be getting out, to be working, to be doing something. And it's such a long time that you've been living in direct provision.
Yeah, it's actually not a normal life. You cannot expect somebody, even for a month or 2 months, you just wake up and go to bed. And, you know, like most of the people, we eat on the bed, and you eat, you sleep there. And, you know, it's not even healthy to your physical healthy, you know, like it kind of like food does not digest really well, you know, because the canteen is only open for hours, like for an hour and a half. And you can't even eat and think of like sitting down there. You have to eat. You have to take your food either to the room, or you have to sit in the canteen. So, you know, it's a very, very complex life.
And currently there is a lot of people in your situation, Ellie, living in direct provision in Ireland for a long time.
Exactly. There are many people that, you know, they've not been, their cases, they've not been processed for a very, very long time. And, you know, we also have now, like, new numbers, like a lot of new numbers that they're just coming in. So it still goes on with a complex system. Like, it's still very, very complicated. Nothing much is not changed yet.
As you said, there hasn't been a lot of change in your experience over the last number of years. What changes would you like to see happen?
I mean, I'd like to see direct provision end. I'd like to see people being allowed to be given a normal, dignified life. You know, being able to make decisions of themselves each and every day. You know, because the type of life that we are being put, it kind of causes a lot of complication, because people want to survive, you know, like there's crime, there is prostitution, there is many stuff, and even the right to work that we have now, I mean, the way the government they've portrayed, it's not everyone that has got a right to work. Like, I am on system, and I'm still, that right to work doesn't even stand for me. And there are also people that they've just come in that they're not even entitled to get that right to work, but because they don't understand, they're being going out there and get jobs and being exploited. And this is, like, not a good thing to happen at all, because it also creates, like, false headlines. So, yeah.
Because I know it's very difficult. There were some changes made to those who could work, but it's made very difficult because you have to have offered a certain salary and have saved a certain amount. It makes it, for many people in direct provision centres, it makes it almost impossible, because you're living on literally a few euros a week.
Yeah, we're living on a few euros a week, which is 21 euros 6 days a week. And this week, people just got bonus. I remember I was talking to other few people yesterday, like, what are you doing on Christmas? And people, like, seem to know what to do. And people were like, oh, you know, when I went to the bank today, I found, like, 42 euros. I was like, yeah, that's your Christmas bonus. So, you know, like, you know, it's a very, very harsh life. And what can you do with a 50 euro? I mean, with a 42 euro on a Christmas time when you have energy and, you know, and the life to go out and make a living for yourself and to look after your kids. I think it's just insulting. You know, I mean, some people, they don't even get it. Like, okay, asylum seekers, they do complain. We do complain, like, for a normal life. But what you have to understand, we are not complaining. We are very, very grateful for what we have. But what we have at the moment is something that's forced on us, not something that if we're given a choice, we could decide to live that life.
Mm, and as you say, it's not your choice, and you want to be able to live a more normal life. And it's especially difficult, I imagine, Ellie, when you have children who, you know, they're going to school, but they're not coming back to kind of like a family home situation. That must be really difficult for your kids. How are your kids?
I mean, they're surviving, they're trying, they're kids, you know. You can't tell much what goes on in their head, but, you know, it's a system that it distracts family, you know. Kids cannot cope, and it's very, very hard. They get by every day, and it's, I mean, that's life, because they don't have much choice, but that's a living, so, yeah.
Tell us a little bit about one of the things that you have done since you've come to Ireland. Is a really fantastic initiative, which is called Our Table. Tell us about that initiative, Ellie.
Yeah, so, you know, like, after living in this system for this long time, I really had to find my own way of coping, because unfortunately the time when I was coming, I didn't bring my family. So I really had to find the means of standing up and live for them. So I was really lucky that at that time I got internship with IRC, and from there I started working with my fair asylum seeker, doing a lot of different things. And one of those were, like, bringing women outside, women and men outside direct provision, and, you know, being able to make food. But we didn't have, like, enough resources. Unfortunately enough, in 2015 is when I met a lady who was a business lady, a friend of mine, and then we co-founded Our Table, and then Our Table started, and we started cooking in a community center kitchens, invite people food to eat, and people seem to like idea, and then we went as far as have a pop-up dinner in Project Art Center, which really went well. And from there, we opened a pop-up cafe for 3 months in Project Arts, which it was very, very great, and it was responded really well. And since then, I was invited to go to Ballymaloe, where I stayed with Dalina Allen for almost 4 months. And from there, I came back. And unfortunately, at that time, my friend couldn't go on with helping out with Our Table, because she had a lot of things to do. But I took it on anyway, because when I was coming from Ballymaloe, you know, I could regain my strength and my confidence. So, you know, so I continued till now. Our Table is going stronger and stronger, and we feed people around around the whole country. We've been traveling a lot, serving food and also doing community events and also being able to employ people and people volunteer and also a space where people can come and, you know, break bread and meet people, meet new communities and, you know, like really integrate into the Irish community, because that's one thing which is very, very hard for people who are just coming in this country to integrate into Irish community. The first conversation are really, really very, very difficult. So that's something that our table has also helped to bridge in about.
Bridging those gaps through breaking bread together. So yeah. You have an event on the 15th of December, Ellie?
Yeah, so I have an event on the 15th December, which is going to be in a Mercy Joyce Secondary School in Inchicore, and it's a Christmas party, and it's going to be one of the big parties. Last year we had a big party where, unfortunately, the person who helped us, I mean, we lost him. He was an Irish man. We lost him, which is, may his soul rest in peace. And this year again, a few friends of mine, which is Irish girl Laura and Heather, they step up and raise funds for us. So they campaigned for our Christmas party because it was not going on. I didn't have the budget. So anyway, they raised good money that, you know, we are going to have a live band, and we are going to have an Afro DJ, and we are going to have choir, we are going to have food, and we are going to have presents. So it's going to be exciting.
It sounds like it's going to be a really, really lovely day on the 15th. And if people can't make it, is there a store in Dublin supplying some of the food products?
Yeah, so there is. They can find our food products at the moment in the Good Food Store. But I think from January, because we were rebranding the whole brand, so we were a little bit late in November, so now we only have in a Good Food Store. But I think by January, going up next year, it's going to be like a really, really hot sauce.
Not for the faint-hearted by the sounds of it. Ellie, thank you so much for joining us on the programme this morning. Hopefully that will be a blessed event on the 15th of December, and thank you for the work that you're continuing to do with our table as well.
Thank you so much. We are looking much forward to 15th, and thank you so much for having me, and have a blessed day.
You too, Ellie. That's Ellie Kasiombe, who's the co-founder and director of Our Table. If you want to find out more, maybe head along to that event. You can go to the website ourtable.ie. Well, our next guest is going to be sharing with us a little bit of the story of his family and the heartbreak that they endured in 2006, and then what has happened since then and the setting up of an incredible foundation that does work to help families who've had a similar experience to them. On the line to tell us a little bit more, we have the co-founder of Cleaners Foundation, Brendan Ring. Brendan, good morning to you.
Good morning, Wendy.
So, Brendan, maybe first of all, just tell us a little bit about your family and your story and a little bit about your daughter, Cleena.
Our family, is my wife, Terry, and we had two children, Cleena and Colm, and Cleena was our only daughter, and in 1998, when she was just 7 going on 8, she went to school on a Friday morning, and when she came home in the evening, she had a mark underneath her eye, and Terry, her mom, asked her what had happened, and she said that she'd bumped into the blackboard leaving school. And we were concerned, or Terry was concerned at the time. We brought it to our local GP, and he obviously suspected something was wrong with Cleena, so he sent us directly here to the Limerick University Hospital at the time to have her checked on. I was at work at the time, and quite busy, and later on that evening I got a call from Terry. She felt maybe it was necessary for me to come in, that they weren't entirely happy with Cleena. So that was a Friday evening. It all happened very, very quickly, and we arrived in there. We stayed overnight with Cleena at the time, and next morning we met one of the consultants in Limerick, and a lady consultant, and she said, look, we have to move Cleena to Cork. We suspect that she has a brain tumour. So that was the beginning of our journey with Cleena, being told that she had a suspected brain tumour, and we travelled by car, even though they wanted us to go by ambulance. We travelled by car because we didn't want to upset her, because as I said, she was only 7. And we arrived in Cork, and unfortunately on Sunday morning, after more scans during Saturday and Saturday night, it was confirmed that she had an inoperable brain tumour. So that was Cleena, and
so what happened after you got this news? Obviously, I imagine, Brendan, you probably felt like your world was kind of crumbling around you, but then you're thinking of your beautiful little girl who's just 7, trying to be strong for her. It was inoperable, so was there any treatment path for Cleena at that time?
Right then, no. It was a low-grade astrocytoma. Surgery was ruled out completely because of the location of the tumour. So between the end of November and all this month of December, we had to decide what to do and do different conversations and meetings. Kleena went down the route of having to have oncology chemotherapy in Dublin, in Crumlin Children's Hospital.
And what was that like for her at that time and for you as a family? Because, you know, I guess people don't often think of just some of the practical things. There's the treatment that the child is having, which is very difficult in mm-hmm. and of itself. But then there's practical things like having to travel, in your case, from Limerick up and down to Crumlin. Food there, where did you stay? How did all that sort of thing work, Brendan?
Well, it was all very sudden, as I said, and very difficult. And you're right, there is some superb treatment for our children, particularly in Temple Street and in Crumlin. But a huge problem besides Tina's illness, and she was fantastic. I mean, she kept us going. Her bravery was unbelievable, how she dealt with her illness. I just couldn't describe it. But on the practical terms, financially, in relation to being able to travel with Tina, because her protocol in Dublin, it was supposed to be 12 months, but it got extended to 18 months because there were times we arrived there with Tina and she just couldn't have her treatment because she was neutropenic, her bloods weren't right and so forth. So we spent an awful lot of time literally moving from Dublin to Limerick on an ongoing basis for a year and a half. And there was a huge amount of cost in relation to car parking, the cost of travelling to Dublin itself, whether it was by car or by train, staying overnight in Dublin on lots of occasions. All the costs were building up. Terry had to take time out of her job. She actually stopped working at that time. So we quickly realised, you know, that, you know, there was a huge financial struggle as well as having the whole trauma of dealing with Kleena. And obviously we had a child at home as well at the time, Colm, who was literally dropped there on his own, and we had to just pass him on to family members to try and look after him while we were away taking care of Kleena at the time, you know. And Kleena's illness, unfortunately, you know, even though we did lose Tina and our anniversary was just last Sunday, we had 8 years of being with her, and not just alone being going to Dublin, but she spent quite a lot of time in Cork at the end of her life. Actually, we spent 4 months with her in a coma as such. Tina was in a coma living in Cork, again, racking up a huge amount of costs in relation to being with her, being beside her bedside all the time. And that just went on for 8 years. It's very difficult, and that's why we have Kleena's Foundation now, because we fully realise that right now, even today, there are thousands of children and parents that have to continuously travel around the country to hospitals getting their children looked after, and everybody's forgetting about the one major thing. Yes, they will be taken care of beautifully by our hospitals, but there's a huge cost involved in just parking and staying over and fuel cost and everything else that goes with that.
All of these extra stresses that families really just don't need when they just want to support their sick child as best they can. And that's as you said, Brendan, the reason why you set up Kleena's Foundation. Tell us a little bit more about setting it up and the work that you do now.
Well, after Kleena died, We've got a lot of help from a lot of different people, so we wanted to give something back. And it was a chord that struck with us was this whole area about how people were surviving financially to be able to support their children on an ongoing basis. So that formed Kleena's Foundation. And what we do is we raise funds for families to allow them to be with their children in hospital, because, again, we noticed that when we were with Kleena, and particularly at the end of her life, is that there were no families or parents with their children in the hospitals. They had to go to work, and that's terrible to say that they couldn't afford to be there. So what we do in Kleena's Foundation is we provide the financial support for those families to be able to be beside their children in their hospitals. And we've been doing that now since Kleena's death. She died 12 years ago, so about 11 years now, and we've helped 550 families plus, and in 29 counties throughout the whole of Ireland. And we've been helping these families and parents to be able to spend time with their children, either to bring them home and to their homes, to be able to have, say, warm homes. So some homes we put oil into, literally at Christmas time to bring children out of hospital so they could spend time at home, or indeed for those kids whose parents can't afford to go and see them at Christmas time, that we would be paying, and not just Christmas, but all year round, be able to pay for those additional out-of-pocket expenses that people just forget about and don't realise. You actually have to be in the situation to fully understand what it's like to have a huge trauma, like being told that your child has a life-limiting or a serious or illness, and then financially you're struggling to be able to pay the bills. So that we're trying to, in a little way, trying to support those families through that awful time. And we've been doing that, as I said, for the last 11 years now.
And with the hundreds of families, Brendan, that you've helped, what's the response been just with alleviating that little bit of a burden? Whether it's, I mean, it is devastating to think of a family not being able to afford to be by their sick child's bedside. But as you say, you have to be in that situation to fully understand it.
Well, we have a very simple process in relation to people applying for funding from Cleanest Foundation, because a lot of the families we deal with, unfortunately, children die very soon after being diagnosed with a serious illness, babies and so forth. We were blessed in the sense that Cleanest was spared for almost 8 years, but we're conscious that there are families that get news and they literally have weeks, months, and definitely a lot of cases, over 400 cases, less than 1 year. So we've got to be able to fund them straight away. So we do that very speedily if we have the funding, and that's the challenge. But look, as late as yesterday, we received letters in the post from families, and they're just heart-wrenching to really read them, and when you feel for what this funding means to them to be able to, enjoy Christmas, for instance, with their children and with their other siblings. And we're conscious, too, that, most families have other siblings, and we call those the shadow children, that they're being ignored and not looked after because there's somebody seriously sick, just like Cliona. So our funding is able to make somebody's Christmas, as enjoyable as possible. And I am very, very conscious. Look, our daughter Cliona died the 2nd of December, and it was the worst nightmare of our lives. Everybody was enjoying the Christmas. We just could not. So I know people listening this morning are probably, some of your families listening in are in that situation. And look, it's very, very difficult. But we want to be able to help them to enjoy this Christmas particularly. And please God, whatever happens next year, look, we don't know. But at least we will try our very best to take away the financial burden from these families.
One of the ways, Brendan, people can support is a book that has been written by Kiva, who's just 11. Yes. Tell us a bit about this book then.
Look, Kiva, it's Kiva Delaney. She's an 11-year-old child. She's in County Carlow. She's daughter to Marisa and Eric Delaney, and they have two other children as well. She penned and sketched the book very speedily in her mind, and jotted it down while she was on holidays a number of years ago. But prior to that, her mum, I believe, had been visiting a hospital in Kilkenny and had picked up a leaflet about our charity, and had kind of in her mind had said, I'm going to do something for this charity sometime. And all of a sudden, like as life goes on, coincidences happen, and Kiva came along to her mum and said, Mum, I have an idea about a book. And she showed us some of her handwritten notes, and it was about this child who ended up in hospital, just like our children end up in hospitals. And her name was Melissa, and Melissa had dolls at home, 7 dolls, and Melissa had left the dolls in the care of her sister Anne, and said, look after these dolls while I'm in hospital. But the problem is, when she's in hospital, Anne isn't doing a great job, so the dolls write notes or letters to Melissa saying, we need you home, because they're complaining that Anne isn't looking after them very well. And for instance, just one story is, one of the dolls ends up outside in the garden and in the kennel with the dog. It's covered with dog hairs, it's getting dirty. And she's saying, oh, Melissa, when you were here at home, this didn't happen. Please, we need you at home. And in a way, it's just really everything happening together in unison. That's what we're trying to do, is to look after the family. So Melissa is seeing life through our eyes only for, we're not trying to get her home to our dolls, we're trying to get her home to our family. But all children have dolls, and it's Christmas time, and, it's so appropriate. So Kiva, just we were just blown away by the fact that you choose Cliona's Foundation, and we published a book And Dun Stores have been unbelievably supportive. It's in all the major stores nationwide. It's also online at Dun Stores. And all the €8 from the book sales are going directly to Cleanest Foundation. The book has been published, has been stocked in Dun Stores with no charge. It's all the proceeds, and all 100% are coming to Cleanest Foundation. You know, it's amazing. An 11-year-old child has been able to help us in an unbelievable way, never like we've been helped before, even though there are fantastic supporters of our charity. It just has come at a great time.
It's a beautiful, heartwarming story. And please God, Brennan, many of those books are sold. Thank you so much for coming on Spirit Radio this morning, for telling us about the incredible work of Cleanest Foundation and for sharing with us about Cleana as well. We really appreciate it. That's Brendan Ring there talking about Cleanest Foundation. The book that Brendan was talking about there, it's called The Doll's Complaints. The book is actually going to be launched on Saturday in Dun Stores in St Stephen's Green in Dublin at 2:30 with Miriam O'Callaghan, and in Dun Stores on Childers Road in Limerick on Monday the 10th at 3:30 with Joe Schmidt launching the book that day. Lots of well-known faces have gotten behind it. There's a promo video for Keith Duffy, Ronan Keating, Daniel O'Donnell, to name but a few. A lot of the Munster rugby team. If you want to find out more about the work of Cleanest Foundation, you can go to their website, cleanestfoundation.ie, and you can support their work that way. But if you are in Dun Stores, look out for The Doll's Complaints, put together by 11-year-old Kiva Delaney. It's on sale in Dun Stores nationwide. It costs €8. All the proceeds are going to Cleanest Foundation. What a truly a remarkable young girl. Well, in terms of sharing our faith with young people, it's so important, I know, to so many people listening. And our next guest is involved with an upcoming event that's looking at that, youth ministry. So reaching out to young people, sharing our faith with young people. It's actually taking place in South Dublin tomorrow, and it's looking to just look at, well, what are the barriers? What are the difficulties facing youth ministry in Ireland today? And what can we actually do about it? So on the line, tell us a little bit more about the Engage Catholic Youth Ministry Conference, and also just this morning, give us some practical advice and practical tips. We have the keynote speaker from the conference, David Wells. David, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So tell us a little bit about your experience of sharing faith with young people.
Oh my goodness. So I've spent a bit of my time in my career in residential youth work. I was a teacher for 10 years in high schools. I've taught in universities. And nowadays I work largely with people who work with young people. So I've been sort of loosely or indirectly connected with them all my life, really. And most importantly, I'm a dad. 24, 22 and 20 year old kids these days. So they've taught me everything I could possibly learn. Yeah,
you've learned a lot in those years with your own kids. And I guess maybe in a way, a lot of working with young people in youth ministry, it's a similar goal to parents. You know, we as parents, when faith is important to us and we want to share it with our kids, but sometimes we struggle to do it.
Oh my goodness. I do a lot of work with parents, and I say, do you know, in some respects, isn't this interesting about people, that the most important things in life are often the things we talk about least. We don't talk about birth or death or the issues. We avoid politics. And strangely, we avoid religion. And, you know, it's tragic because it causes people so much pain. The things that young people want to talk about are often the things their parents don't seem able to talk about.
And so how do you make that shift, really?
Oh, my goodness.
It's not an easy question, I know.
No, it's a great question, and it's a really good question to, you know, I've tried to create a situation. If we're talking about me being a dad, you know, I've tried really hard to listen to them so that they don't feel too preached at. And some of your listeners will be teachers, and it's very easy to slip into teacher mode and patronize them. But it seems to me that the most important thing is, am I the sort of dad that they'd want to ask more than have me tell? And, you know, if there's a good climate of question and dialogue going on, eventually my instinct is that people come to good decisions. But it is tricky, and there'll be lots of parents listening today will be going, you know, I'm really worried about my kids, about the direction they're taking. And, you know, it is a really hard dialogue to have with them.
And I think it's similar to parents might be similar to people's experience in their local parish, where, you know, they want to be able to reach out to young people, have more young people in their parish. But I feel we're in a moment, certainly in Ireland, where we're almost kind of paralysed by the amount of work that needs to be done, and fear as well. Is that holding us back?
Oh, I think you're so on the money there, because actually, if I could just take this slight strain off that comment, it's all over the world. And, you know, if I do have a privilege right now, it's the fact that I am travelling. I've just come back from Vancouver. Bishops there are saying the same thing. I've been in New Zealand recently. You know, the churches there are saying the same thing. So I do realise that there are some accelerated issues in Ireland over the last 10 years. But I would say, please don't imagine it's your fault. Everywhere I'm going, there is this concern, growing anxiety, that in some ways we're not serving the young well at all. And it does seem to me to be a worldwide issue.
Is part of the process, David, starting, just doing something rather than nothing?
Yeah. So, you know, so I'm a Catholic, and, you know, I draw some inspiration from what Pope Francis is saying at the moment. And, you know, he seems to be shifting things slightly. What strikes me is this: if you begin in a position of anxiety, and you're coming at this like young people are a problem, and you're coming at it from a position of worry, then actually it's not great, because what then follows tends to be assumptions. And these assumptions often lead to all sorts of ideas and practices which, you know, are very well-intentioned, you know, and they can be good. But by and large, they demand an awful lot and often merit very little fruit. I think the first thing anybody who wants to reach out to the young has got to do, forgive me, and this will sound patronising, is almost lighten up. Because, you know, anxiety and fear and a sense of disappointment is not attractive to anybody. This Pope is talking loads about joy, and it's just what we need in the church right now, is a kind of an investment, a kind of huge insert of joy and enthusiasm, which, by the way, in the history of the churches, tends to be the young. So it's no wonder that the church feels a bit tired and a bit alienated at the moment, because the young are largely missing.
So it's something so simple, really, but yet it requires, David, an attitude shift. And I love when Pope Francis talks about that. You know, he says, don't be going around with gloomy faces. You know, joy is infectious. And
yeah,
it's that whole
absolutely
thing.
He had this great phrase, didn't he, in Chile last year when he was speaking to the young. And he said, you know, the church often looks like it's sucking a lemon. And I'm going to talk about joy tomorrow. It's tempting to come up with programs and so on. And all these things are important. But the first really practical shift, you know, is to look, this sounds really ridiculous, but actually to look like we enjoy it. I mean, when was the last time anybody was attracted to misery? And, you know, for me, I'm part of a faith tradition that's made me strong. It's helped me with life choices. It's fended off disappointment and depression. And, you know, there's something so special about what faith can offer people that we've tended to come at this from the wrong starting point. We need a serious infusion of joy. I really believe that.
And you know what? It is powerful. And so often, I think that we overcomplicate it. And it's a case of, well, if you just live your faith as you're meant to, that witness will not only hopefully be attractive to young people, but to others as well, and how you're choosing to live your life. In terms of the event tomorrow, David, tell us a little bit about some of the other things that you're going to touch on.
Well, OK, so firstly, thank you for that. And it sounds like you should be speaking at it too, really. The thing that strikes me is, two things. Firstly, the current Pope, and he's not the first one to do this, is really encouraging Catholics to think about the virtues. Because it's the virtues that attract people, you know, virtues of mercy, virtues of joy, virtues of compassion and confidence and courage. All these things are really attractive. I think, and particularly when I think of England at the moment, you know, we're desperate for leaders who show integrity and authenticity. And often we've lost faith in our politicians because, you know, they seem to be just looking for the popular thing. Now, when you start leading from a place of virtue, you're attractive anyway. And actually, to some extent, I'm saying to volunteers in parishes, you know, get the virtues right. And it almost doesn't matter what program you use, it will work. And I've found that people are just so excited when they meet integrity and enthusiasm and joy. But, you know, the best of programs and the best of strategies are going to run nowhere if we don't look like we believe it. And of course, it's a bit tempting then to say, well, that can sound a bit false. But I'm not suggesting a kind of Disney-esque approach to things. I'll be talking a lot about the virtues tomorrow. And the other thing, just very briefly, is I'll be talking a little bit about an emerging theology in the church. It's not new, but it's gaining a lot of attention, is the theology of accompaniment, which is based really loosely on Luke chapter 24, the journey on the road to Emmaus, where really we're saying, look, will you stop looking for signs of total and complete transformation and start looking for signs of progress? Because sometimes we're asking children to be complete saints by the time they're seven. And, you know, what we've really got to do is understand how to walk shoulder to shoulder with people through the good and the bad times. That is going to be attractive. And when we learn to do that and we learn to do it well, we'll have a fresh spring.
And that idea of accompaniment, again, something Pope Francis has himself also talked about a lot. I think that's something, David, that people struggle with, especially I found, and I remember being given this advice myself as I was coming back into my faith, and my brother, Father Nicholas, said, look, you're going to be tempted to be on fire because you're so buzzing with the faith, and you know what you're going to do? You're going to wreck everyone's head by going over the top, you know? And it can be a process, can't it, to kind of learn that, really, that gift of accompanying someone and having and praying for the wisdom to be able to know how to do that in the right way.
Absolutely. And going back to the first part of our conversation, what I think is really interesting is sometimes the people we can't accompany particularly well are the people we really love. I meet lots of people who say, you know, I'm really struggling to talk to my husband about this, or my wife and my teenage kids and so on. But the notion of discipleship is all the way through the Gospels. It's a walking with and a gradual transformation. And Jesus doesn't seem to be, you know, although ultimately this is about salvation, Jesus seems to recognize that people come at this gradually and slowly, and that their eyes are opened. And we have so many stories in the scriptures of people only understanding after the event. Now, my instinct is that a lot of us, particularly those who grow up in churches, kind of had an inherited experience. It was beautiful. It was important. But at some stage, the light has to come on, and you have to recognize it as your own. And that's why I think those young years are so vital. There's so often a sort of light coming on moment, and you go, oh my goodness, you know, it is real. But then it is going to take a lifetime to understand what just happened, to recognize how to live it, and to be an accompanier yourself. And at 56, you know, I am just learning some of the most important lessons. So this principle of accompaniment is something I'd like to talk about a little bit tomorrow. And not that it's new to Ireland at all, but, you know, it would be good to explore that with the Irish Church and to see, how that can be lived out practically.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be a very fruitful day, David, please God. And hopefully you'll have lots of interesting discussions at the event tomorrow.
Well, look, thank you so much for drawing people's attention to it. And, you know, if there's anybody listening and they can make their way there, please get down there and come and join us.
David Wells, thanks so much for joining us on the programme this morning. So the conference that we are speaking about is the Engage Catholic Youth Ministry Conference. It's taking place tomorrow, the 8th of December, at the Boylan Community Centre, which is in Dunleary in South County Dublin. All the details are on engageyouth.ie.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.